Edition, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, your home for original reporting.
I'm Deborah Rodriguez. President Biden took a partial victory for a strengthening economy in last night's State of the Union address, his first before a divided Congress.
Thanks to what you've all done, we're exporting American products and creating American jobs. But we have more to do. But here at home, inflation is coming down.
Our respondent, Nancy Cordes from Washington.
President Biden's second State of the Union address started with a show of bipartisanship as he congratulated the new House Speaker, Republican Kevin McCarthy.
Speaker, I don't want to ruin your reputation, but I look forward to working with you.
But the night quickly took a turn. McCarthy had to shush members of his own party at least four times as they booed and interrupted the president when he talked about China, about fentanyl, and when he noted that some Republicans have proposed cutting Medicare and Social Security.
British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak greeted Ukraine's president on the tarmac when he arrived for a surprise visit to London. The two men met at 10 Downing Street. Then Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the British Parliament in a bid for more military support.
We will always come out on top of evil. This lies at the core of our, but also your, traditions.
Zelensky is also meeting with King Charles. It's a race against time to find additional survivors trapped in massive mounds of rubble in the frigid cold after Monday's 7.8 earthquake that devastated parts of Turkey and Syria. Today, the death toll topped 11,000. In Pyongyang, marked the 75th anniversary of the country's army. Small government-organized groups performed. Others held signs praising the Korean People's Army. The King gets a new title after last night's Lakers game. CBS's Steve Futterman was there.
What a moment for LeBron James. He is now the NBA's all-time leading scorer. And the crowd here chanting MVP. He entered the league 20 years ago, and tonight he attains one of the greatest records in basketball.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who held the title for almost 40 years, was there to congratulate his successor.
LeBron has conducted himself with class. He had a plan. He came right out of high school and went after excellence on the court.
CVS is taking a giant plunge into primary medical care. It's reached a $10.6 billion all-cash deal to buy clinic owner Oak Street Health. It adds hundreds of senior clinics, as well as about 600 physicians and nurse practitioners for COVID vaccinations, strep tests, and other services at CVS pharmacies. S&P futures down 20, Dow futures off 119. This is CBS News.
You know, it's true.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk. From Big Bend to Menominee Falls. Always streaming at WAUKradio.com.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. President Biden in Wisconsin today following up last night's State of the Union speech.
Unemployment rate is 3.4%, a 50-year low. Gas prices are down more than $1.50, and we're going to make sure the oil companies start playing their honest role. It's going to go down further. Inflation has fallen 6 months straight, and inflation is coming down. Take-home pay of workers is going up slightly. Manufacturing is rebounding.
He visited a union apprenticeship training center near Madison to highlight his jobs and economic plan. Governor Evers says the murder of a Milwaukee police officer yesterday was due to a failure to address gun violence. Republicans blame Milwaukee's approach to crime. In sports, Marquette lost to UConn last night, 87-72. Tonight, the Badgers try to get back in the win column at Penn State. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Hey everybody, how we doing? I'm Charlie Behrens, inviting you to join me Saturdays and or Sundays at noon. It's a horse apiece, whatever you decide. We're doing the Cripes Cast, where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and it's more fun than a six-pack of Jolly Good. Okay, the pride of Random Lake, that Jolly Good is. Anyway, it's on your Civic Media station and the Civic Media app. And do me a favor, yeah, tell your folks I says hi. Okay, real good.
Governor Tony Evers, Tim Michaels said you had gone, quote, full woke. Dr. Jill Underlie said that somebody who says that has no idea what we're doing in schools to make sure kids feel safe.
We want to make sure all kids feel supported. Tim Michaels, we don't teach CRT in our schools. You got to come to the present century here, Tim, and be cognizant of what actually goes in the schools. My guess is you've never been in a public school in Wisconsin.
Up North News Radio with Pat Krylo airs at its new time from 6 to 8 a.m. weekdays across Civic Media.
You know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold, 1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003, 125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football. You're about to find out. Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram, Monday mornings at 8 on The Shaw and on the Civic Media app.
WAUK 540 AM, Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com. The Shaw 101 FM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I come back to this Tennessee Speaker of the House, this Cameron Sexton, which is just amazing to me. The fact that they're saying that he wants to forego federal funding so that they can educate the children of Tennessee like Tennessee wants. And I come back to, you know, it's, you know, who's going to suffer in this. And that's the point. The cruelty is always the point. But here to share some thoughts on, well, on the education front, and share some thoughts on their most recent awarding of a pretty sizable amount of money to a school district down in Florida, their latest round of AFT's Innovation Funds, What Kids and Community Needs grants. They've so far committed $1.6 million since the pandemic to schools and to teachers across the country, which is incredible. That's why I've asked Randy Weingarten, the president of AFT, to come share some thoughts with us. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course. For you, always, Rick.
I want to talk about these innovation grants. I mean, this, yesterday I talked a little bit about the fact that in the UK, teachers are giving out toothpaste and toothbrushes because, you know, things are so bad that their kids' dental hygiene's going by. And I was talking about teachers that I've known in the past who keep, you know, a storage locker full of canned goods to send home with kids. This stuff all seems to roll down to teachers who, through the goodness of their hearts, are digging into their own pockets. Does it see you guys, you're taking this on? Pretty impressive.
So look, that is who teachers are. And, you know, what we've tried to do, and all of this, the Innovation Fund, it's in our Constitution now in terms of trying to take good ideas that people have on the ground, that teachers have, that parents have, and try to translate into the action as long as people are working together. And that's what the idea behind the Innovation Fund has always been for the last 10 years. But what we tried to do with COVID is basically say, there's so many needs. Let's do mini grants instead of big grants. And we've given 57 grants out in the last 3 years to try to help at a local level as long as people are working together. And so in Florida, the contrast is just huge between what DeSantis is doing to try to undermine schools and create fear and not let people have agency or voice and divide, you know, parents or attempt to divide people against each other. And what we're trying to do is actually fix these problems, actually problem solve, actually get teachers, recruit and retain teachers, have grow your own programs so people from community can become paraprofessionals and bus drivers and then teachers, to do things like expand emotional social supports, how do you create systems for that, how do you expand career tech ed programs and pathways. That's what our union is trying to do. And I was really just moved that Rocky Hanna, who's a fantastic superintendent in Tallahassee, and our union leader there, Scott Mazur, they both together wanted to announce this grant, and I wanted to do it with them. And so the contrast is clear between the helpers, as Mr. Rogers would say, the problem solvers, versus the people who are actually trying to hurt kids and strip away respect and dignity, all in a fear-based strategy, which is what DeSantis is doing.
And not just DeSantis. I mean, you saw Sarah Huckabee Sanders came out with her. Her plan, which is unlimited charter schools, unlimited number of transfers, so we can bounce kids all over the place as these charter schools fail, and just down the, it's basically the wet dream wish list of the extreme right who want to privatize and profitize education.
So this is what I want to. I'm so glad you raised this one, Rick, because here you had the president of the United States of America really spell out in his State of the Union an economic strategy that would basically help virtually everyone, and talk to people who have lost their jobs because of these kind of privatization and pulling jobs away. You know, the people that Sarah Huckabee Sanders used to work for, what they believed in. And he does this whole speech, and then she says, I'm anti-woke. And what she actually proposed today was essentially getting rid of public education. This is the Betsy DeVos playbook. This is the DeSantis playbook. This is the, we don't want to have schools be the center of communities. We want to just privatize and defund them and get rid of them and destabilize them. So there's no kind of community square. There's no centerpiece of community in America. And this is what's so crazy about this. We did a poll of parents and voters right after the election in December. NYSET, our New York affiliate, just did one right now about a week ago in terms of charters. And what we're seeing overwhelmingly is that there is a greater split than I've seen in years when you ask the question, do you want to strengthen public schools for all of our kids, or do you want to have more private choices or, you know, school choice? And in our polling, we see an 80-20 split, that people want to strengthen public schools. And in the NYSET polling, the New York State polling, it was an 85-15 split that they want to strengthen public schools over charters.
Yeah.
So what you have here is this very, this basically power elite billionaires that just want to get rid of public schools or destabilize them, which is not what the public wants. They want, we want to focus on learning loss. They want our kids to be okay. We have to focus on mental health. We have to focus on the after effects of COVID. But instead of focusing on the after effects of COVID and helping our kids be okay and strengthening our public schools, they just want to use the pretext of woke and this and that and fear to just undermine, destabilize, or kill them.
Yeah.
And that's what this is all about. Use the fear to basically take the money that is actually supposed to be for children. And actually, we have a big job right now, which is helping kids overcome the after effects of COVID. So I'm going to say to all these folks, we want every public school to be a place where parents want to send their kids, educators want to work, and kids thrive. And the last thing I'll say is this. Look at the difference between what Sarah Huckabee Sanders did today after saying, oh, she was going to propose something marvelous yesterday in her rebuttal. When the president of the United States said, and by the way, teachers really deserve, public school teachers need a raise, everyone in that room stood up and cheered.
Yep.
I've never seen that. So people get what teachers do, but then you have this right-wing extremism that basically makes it harder and hampers them from doing all this because of them taking away the money and actually restricting what teachers are saying to kids or answering kids' questions or trying to teach kids and really reach them to make sure they're okay for the today and tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, what she's proposed is, again, it's the laundry list of privatize and profitize. And I find it interesting that she says, you know, we're gonna raise the salaries from $36,000 to start to $50,000. You could have done that without destroying public education. You could reward teachers who work in neighborhood schools and community schools and draw in the best people without all of the unlimited charter stuff and all the, because look, it hasn't really worked. I mean, the studies are fairly conclusive. It hasn't really worked.
Actually, what we're seeing in the studies in terms of both vouchers and charters is that charters basically do what public schools do, you know, and I say this from someone who's actually run a charter for the last 10 years. One of my predecessors actually was the one who invented charters as a way of trying to innovate and change, not as a way of kind of competing, but on vouchers, they actually hurt the kids that get the vouchers. They haven't over the long term helped in terms of any kind of standards, and they're pretty discriminatory, and they take money away from the other schools and the other kids. So there's if there were studies that showed that these things worked over the course of the last 20 years, don't you think that these folks who promote these schemes would be shouting those studies from the rooftops?
Oh, absolutely. Especially the cyber charter
because
people.
Except they don't exist. So, right. You know, it's just, it is the difference. People, after COVID, it is obvious, I hope to everyone, that in-school learning is really important. And that public schools serve a really important role in this country. So our job is to strengthen them for all of our kids, not to constantly have something that pulls away and pulls away and pulls away at it.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, AFT, AFT.org, the website, if you want to check out more about what they do. I wanted to get your thought on this comment made by the Speaker of the House in Tennessee. He says that they may stop taking the $1.8 billion in federal K through 12 funding because he says basically we'll be able to educate the kids how Tennessee sees fit, which means none of that theory on race or none of those low-income kids or second language or disability, none of that stuff. We're gonna go after our kids. I'm struggling in this moment to not lose my mind over this kind of thinking, but this is the kind of world that they're creating. And then you combine it with what's going on in Iowa with child labor laws. It just seems to me like they're setting the table so that low income and poverty kids living in poverty areas are going to just be, well, warehoused in underfunded public schools and then pushed right into a pipeline of crummy jobs where employers are shielded from liabilities. Or am I being hyperbolic?
Look, I think what's happened is because of the recklessness that we hear from these governors around children, that, you know, we have a sinking feeling that they just don't care. I mean, in Iowa, what they're essentially doing is trying to strip away all the protections that state after state after state have done to protect children from child labor, to shield corporations from liability. Like, look, I know there's a tight labor market, so what we should be doing is paying people an appropriate wage and changing conditions so that these jobs are attractive, not trying to make it okay to hire children again to do this. And I think that's the concern in terms of Iowa. Sorry, I am in New York and we got ambulances and fire trucks and all these other things that come. But the the piece about Tennessee, which is so dangerous, and you see this in, frankly, in Florida, too. You know, Florida basically doesn't want to give its school boards and its localities local control. You know, they want to take the control. So they basically are saying, you know, the governor's office should have the control, not the local government, not the people who are closest to the people. But then they make this, you know, diatribic argument against, you know, against Washington, D.C. And ultimately, what are they really saying? The laws on education that came out of Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s, just like Social Security and Medicare, sorry that I'm being a school teacher right now, those laws were about everybody's freedom, were about trying to make sure that everybody had opportunity. And essentially what they're saying is they want some people to have opportunity and not others.
Yeah, they want to repeal the 20th century.
Or they want, you know, they believe that there should be winners and losers in their state. I believe we should enable everyone to compete effectively and that we give them the tools and the conditions so they can do it. So the disability law, that was about making sure that we don't warehouse kids with disabilities. Why would a governor spit at that money and spit at those rights for disabilities, for kids with disabilities? The same in terms of kids who have been historically disenfranchised. Why not level the playing field? That's what the federal government's role in education has been. And we have fought to get federal money that supplements state and local money so that these districts could have the money to lower class size, to have aids for reading. And frankly, it's as important to poor rural areas as it is to poor urban areas.
Yep.
So it's just rhetoric to basically make a us versus them against the federal government, not caring that it's actually going to hurt kids.
Yeah, the cruelty seems to be the point. Last question I've got for you, though. You mentioned the word, you said compete. And it popped into my head that Florida, the education board down there, or the state board down there, is proposing a new rule that Florida students playing high school sports have to, report their menstrual cycles. Girls are going to have to now report to the state. Are we not really concerned about this on a major level? I know as a parent, I would be outraged. I'm curious your thoughts.
Look, I found it, first off, it's creepy and it's outrageous. But it's interesting to me that, you know, whereas Ron DeSantis has often used his education department and his education secretary as his initial vehicle to do any of this stuff, he quickly said, oh, no, that's not me. It's the education secretary. So I hope that he has realized that this is so creepy and so disgusting and such an invasion of privacy that, you know, this one he's not going to go through with. But, you know, his education secretary appoints 3 or 4 people on this committee that's making this decision about whether or not they're going to, on a mandatory basis, check every girl's menstruation calendar. It's creepy. It's gross. It's an invasion of privacy. And it's basically one more time saying who has freedom and who doesn't.
There you go.
And I really hope they have pulled away from this, and decided not to do this kind of gross invasion of girls' privacy and families' privacy.
I'm right there with you. Randy, I appreciate the time as always. Thanks so much. Keep up the great work. Keep out there fighting for kids. We need you.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Appreciate the time. Again, Randy Weingarten, president of AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. Make sure you check out their website, aft.org. We'll get links out on social media. I'll take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk. Fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in Two segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible two-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to thericksmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at thericksmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I always find it interesting that the people, and again, I go back to my mother, who always said, you know, if someone's pointing their finger at you, accusing you of something, they got three pointing back at them, and chances are they're the ones who are doing what is being accused. And I look at this DeSantis thing, I look at this Florida thing, and I know he's trying to run away from it because I don't know any parent who's thrilled with the idea of any government agency overseeing their daughter's menstrual cycles. I don't even oversee them. And I've got daughters. I don't want to know anything. How creepy. Now remember, these are the people who are saying, everyone's a pedophile. They're all pedophiles. They're all perverts. What you're doing is kind of, in the wheelhouse. Makes you wonder if the attack by Donald Trump this week on DeSantis might be accurate, that he doth protest too much. Very, very, very creepy. But again, I come back to these moments where they show us who they are. They tell us who they are. When do we believe them? Now, look, the Social Security thing. You know, I'm still amazed at that. You know, looking at Mike Lee's face and as they scan the crowd of Republicans, going, "Who, us? No, we wouldn't do such a thing. We're so no. I'm outraged." When there are years and decades of comments of Republicans going, "Yeah, we want to destroy it. We want to privatize it." Now, understand, this is where, on the education front, on the Social Security front, on every front, privatization is their answer. It's their hammer. It's the only hammer in the toolbox. Privatize everything. Give it to corporate interests because the corporations always do better. This belief that markets always are the most efficient way to deal with scarce resource. And again, it depends on which side of the equation you're on. If you're on the side of needing those services and needing those things, then you're screwed. But if it means, rationing and charging more higher prices and all of that, well, yeah, if you're on the controlling side, well, you're aces, man. Whether it's healthcare, whether it's education, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's our roads and bridges, they get it. So it's amazing to me that they would come out and say, no, we wouldn't privatize it. We wouldn't destroy it. No, that's not us. No, we wouldn't do that. When it's their core ideology. And as I've said a number of times, I love having to explain to people their ideology. they spew this kind of free market capitalism without really understanding what it means for working people. This, my friends, where we've got to pay better attention. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you download the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Every week we do
a progressive voice from Beaver Dam to Kenosha. WAUK 540 AM. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. A 7.8 magnitude earthquake in Turkey and Syria has killed more than 2,600 people, and there could be more bodies trapped under buildings. This man says the shaking started in the middle of the night.
Just instinctively, we just ran for our lives out of the building. And then we saw other families just coming out, running for their lives as well from the building.
Authorities in East Palestine, Ohio are warning people a train derailment with dangerous chemicals on board could still blow up. Charles Emix with the Red Cross.
Chaotic. A lot of people don't want to leave their house. They don't understand what the dangers are. Some of them have pets at their home, and it's hard to convince them to get out.
Retired General H.R. McMaster says that Chinese spy balloon clearly violated international law.
Part of a sustained campaign of espionage against the United States. So I'm hoping this is kind of a wake-up call for all of us.
Crews are still working to recover its pieces. CBS News Brief. I'm Monica Ricks.
WAUK 540 AM, New Berlin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matnair. Here's what you need to know. In the race for the 8th Senate District being vacated by Senator Alberta Darling, three Republicans are facing off in the February 21st primary. A national Republican group working to support re-elections of GOP members who voted to impeach former President Trump is out with ads criticizing State Representative Janelle Branchon. Branchon used her position on the Assembly Elections Committee to promote baseless conspiracy theories about the Wisconsin election system. She is facing State Representative Dan Nodal and Thiensville Village President Van Motley in the February 21st primary. The winner will go on to face Jody Habesh-Sinikin of Whitefish Bay. President Biden stopping in Wisconsin today at a training center north of Madison, highlighting his jobs plan. The president delivered the State of the Union address last night. I'm Jane Matnair. This is Civic Media News.
Know him as the nose tackle for the green and gold,
1993 to 1999, and again 2001 to 2003.
125 games, 292 tackles, 7 sacks, and a Super Bowl ring. But there's more to life than stats, and there's more to life than football.
You're about to find out.
Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, featuring Packers legend Gilbert Brown and Earl Ingram.
Monday mornings at 8 on the Shaw and on the Civic Media app.
It makes me smile, and you have a piano, but if you can play the Peanuts theme song.
Oh my gosh.
You know he can.
Yes.
On the Devil's Radio.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love it.
Listen to Max Inc. Radio Saturday night, 6 p.m. to midnight on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian.
I'm really trying hard not to go insane from the mind screw that is this situation. Yes. With I was going to say the GAB, but now it's the WEC, which was audited by the LAB, and then it's now screwed up by the GOP, and we're all SOL. Good for us. Congratulations.
Look at all those acronyms. Yeah.
We're the winners.
Tune in for Dueling Tangents every weekday at 2.
Here's today's STEM tip. Don't throw out that old plastic bottle. Repurpose it by turning it into an awesome terrarium. Just fill it with sand, pebbles, soil, and your favorite plant. It'll grow sealed right in its own ecosystem. Learn more at SheCanSTEM. A message from the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Good tell you one of my favorite parts of the President's State of the Union. Look, there was a lot. If you were a working person and you watched that speech last night, you know the president was talking about you. He was thinking about you. The policies that this administration was moving is all about, it's all about working people. And if you remember our Working Class Heroes radio tour back in October, we were saying, look, this has got to be where Democrats live. We went into those used to be towns. Where they used to make this or they used to make that, Akron, the rubber, former rubber capital of the world, Toledo, the glass capital of the world. People pine for those days. And the fact that this president's talking about rebuilding and not just talking, doing, really important. And that's why I thought it was important to, that he brought the woman from Cincinnati, the iron worker from Cincinnati, to go, you know what? There's that bridge that connects Cincinnati and Kentucky, major economic throughway. They're rebuilding it, and she's going to work on that bridge. And that's what connects with people. And here to share some thoughts on the president's speech and, well, that particular iron worker in that bridge, I've asked Ross Templeton to come talk with us. Ross is the iron worker's political and legislative director. If you want to check out the stuff that the iron workers do, ironworkers.org is the website. Ross, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you, Rick. Glad to be here.
So let's start right here. The speech, did you get to see it, and what'd you think?
I saw it, and I mean, just jaw-dropping, especially the point where he recognized our sister iron worker, Sarah Winmay from Cincinnati, Ohio, Local 44. But the whole part of it, you know, I think he focused really hard on the jobs. He focused really hard on the economic record of the administration. Like you said, the facts are on the ground. You know, he created more jobs in the past 2 years than any other president did in four. So altogether, I mean, it really... he really came through, really did a great job, I think, of highlighting the accomplishments of the administration over the past 2 years.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, look, the one thing I agreed with Donald Trump on when he was in the White House was the need for infrastructure, the need for also, you know, to bring in the need to reshore manufacturing, the need to have better trade deals. You know, there was a lot of talk. In fact, Infrastructure Week every week. Maybe you remember we had 4 years of every week being Infrastructure Week. I remember the cute little pictures. But this president, you know, saying not just saying it, but we're actually getting it done in that bridge that connects Kentucky and Cincinnati, the Brent Spence Bridge. That's been needing to be replaced for decades.
Yeah, that bridge, Brent Spence, it goes from Cincinnati over to Covington, northern Kentucky, and it is terrifying. I don't know if you've ever driven on it, but it's a double-decker bridge. It is covered in rust. The lanes are narrow. The trucks are right on top of you. There are people who live there that will gladly drive a half hour out of their way just to avoid going over that bridge. And it's been like that way for a long time. I talked to iron workers at Local 44 there who say, you know, they were back in the 90s, they were cutting chunks of rust off it. It's expensive to replace. There is a significant portion of America's freight traffic just goes across it, it's a main thoroughfare from the industrial centers in the Midwest down to the South. And nobody ever had the leadership to put the money there to actually get it done. I saw Donald Trump speak right there in front of it in Cincinnati, Ohio, talking about infrastructure. He never delivered. Now they are finally delivering. We got the bipartisan infrastructure law. There are multiple programs putting money into this bridge, and we're going to get it built, and we're going to get it built right.
And it's not just that bridge. I mean, you know, he was in New York to talk about a tunnel. They got another tunnel they're talking about. They're going to be moving on and outside of Baltimore. Just all across this country, there's going to be orange cones and hard hats all over the place. We need this. We need this kind of boost to our economy because of the jobs are going to be created. But also, if we're going to remain competitive globally and you know, this is something, again, the AFL-CIO and the Chamber of Commerce, when they can agree on something, it should be something that the country agrees on. But yet, you said it was a bipartisan bill. There weren't an awful lot of Republicans that jumped onto that.
There weren't a ton in raw numbers, but I'll tell you this. It was a genuinely bipartisan bill. Democrats didn't have enough votes to pass it out of the House or the Senate on their own. Republicans stick their necks out. There were a bunch of them in the Senate and some in the House, and they came together and they passed it. And I will tell you, Republican leadership came after him. You had Kevin McCarthy, you had Donald Trump threatening and going after and directing primary attacks against the Republicans who voted with us on it. And we were there. We fought to defend them. We were able to save a few of them. But But unfortunately, they were a major center of attack. But I give full credit to every Republican who joined the Democrats and made this happen.
No question. The courage it took to stand up against that. But the thing is infrastructure used to be one of those things that we didn't fight over. That bill should have been 100-0 in the Senate and 435 in the House. Look, everybody wants the pothole out front of their house paved. Everybody wants that bridge to be fixed so they don't end up in the drink. Everybody, at least I used to believe that. So the hope is that this is going to be moving us in that direction, that we get stuff done. Now, the other question I wanted to ask you, because, you know, you look at all of this stuff all at once. Do we have enough people? Do we have enough skilled tradespeople to be able to do all of this stuff? Because there's a lot of money going out there. Do we have enough people to do this? Do you have enough members who are going to be able to climb up there? Because you ain't getting me to do it. Do you have enough people to do it?
You know what? I think the people are there who want to do this. We need to get them in the union, get them into the apprenticeship programs. Like you said, this is a lot of work. This is $1.3 trillion in the bipartisan infrastructure law, the Inflation Reduction Act, which has a whole bunch of green energy subsidies that have labor standards on them. That's probably a quarter trillion dollars, but it could be more because of the way that it's built out. And the great thing about it is that it's paired with a lot of labor standards, labor incentives. So, for example, the Inflation Reduction Act subsidies for the green energy industry, they require apprentices on these projects. It helps us pull people into our training programs, get them looped in so that they're able to get out there work on these jobs quickly and help train them up with broad-based skill sets so they can work on other types of projects as well. And I'll say that, you know, both the administration, the iron workers, many other trades, we got to focus here also on diversity because we want to make sure that these jobs are ones that are accessible to everybody. We want people of color. We want women to all be able to slot into these jobs. And there's a lot of partnership with the Department of Labor, along with the Department of Transportation and Energy, to make sure that there are those pre-apprenticeship programs, those pipelines, in order to help get folks into these jobs, provide them the support and the services in order to keep them in these careers. At the end of the day, have that bigger, larger union workforce that has the diversity of the whole country. That's our goal.
Yeah, I always say what we need to be doing is we need to be rebuilding, reviving, and reunionizing this country. And this president is moving us in that direction. With policy, again, I go back and I look at this infrastructure bill. You know, prevailing wage is in that. It wasn't something that was allowed to be stripped out. There are rules in place to ensure that the jobs that are created are good, solid, family-sustaining wage jobs with good benefits and the kind of things that we absolutely need.
Yeah, all of it's there. And in addition to the prevailing wage and additional support for apprenticeship programs that's in the infrastructure law, a lot of these programs, they encourage project labor agreements, you know, making sure that these projects have labor standards on them additionally and have connections into union jobs. And what we've seen in a lot of these projects, Brent Spence, the one in Ohio, is a great example. Out in New London, Connecticut, same day that Biden announced the Brent Spence project, there was a grant that Pete Buttigieg, the transportation secretary, announced at a bridge out in Connecticut. And he highlighted the fact that it's going to be a PLA on that job. And that's another one where we were proud to have an iron worker speak at that program. So it's really, really front and center for us. And really the depth of the labor standards and the way that that all of this legislation is now being used in order to help empower and organize workers, it's incredible. And it all ties back also to an executive order that Biden signed early in office on worker empowerment and organizing. You know, he directed the agencies to say, listen, take these programs that you got and find every way that you can in order to help encourage collective bargaining, which is federal law. That's what the federal government should be doing. And I think that the agencies have done a great job of that. And I think, you know, it's our job as you know, unionists and activists and what have you, to make sure everyone in the union knows about that, how all this stuff is meant to help us as union workers.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Ross Templeton. Ross is the political and legislative director with the Iron Workers. You can check out their website, ironworkers.org. We'll get links out on social media. I can take that out, check that out. Now, you brought up a couple of things there that I'm sure most of my longtime listeners, they understand. But, you know, some people may not get you throughout the PLA thing. People, you know, what's that? You know, I threw out prevailing wage. Why are these important to be put into these bills? Why is it important to have prevailing wage laws to in these work in, on these jobs? Why is it important to have a project labor agreement?
That's a great question. You know, I think the idea is that when the government comes in and starts spending in an industry, you know, whether it's building infrastructure or whether it's helping clean energy projects get off the ground, we want to make sure that the federal dollars are being used to create good jobs, jobs with standards. Prevailing wage is basically a little, it's a different minimum wage for construction projects that have that federal support to make sure that local workers don't get underbid from companies that are coming, trying to come in and exploit their workers in order to make their profit margin. Same thing with project labor agreements. Project labor agreements are just agreements between the project owner and the building trades unions to kind of set the standards that are going to work across the project for wages and benefits and safety conditions. And they're used by the private sector. You know, big companies like Toyota like to use them when they're building their factories. And it's something that the federal government and state governments should have the ability to use, too, in order to help ensure their good jobs in these projects. So it's all stuff that matters. I think there's a lot of union construction workers that may not even realize that they're working on a prevailing wage or PLA project right now. When it comes down to it, it's a huge tool that's beneficial to workers across the country.
And there's a problem. I mean, you know, you just said something that grabbed my attention. You know, Biden's not out there saying, hey, he's not out promoting himself. He isn't doing the Twitter thing. He's not as much of a self-promoter as Trump was. And I've been saying, look, you got to get 15-foot statues out there, 20-foot cardboard cutouts saying, you know, I did this. We need 20-foot signs saying this is under a project labor agreement and paying prevailing wage. This needs to be promoted in a way that going, look, this is smart policy. This is rebuilding our country. Yes, getting us the things that business needs, but it's also helping workers and helping communities. And this is how I keep coming back to, we don't do enough. We don't do enough telling the story.
Well, I think the State of the Union is a big kickoff for Biden on that. You know, he laid out his case there in front of Congress yesterday. Today he was in Madison, Wisconsin, talking about infrastructure and jobs. Tomorrow he's going to be down in Tampa. I think the number I heard was between him and the cabinet secretaries and the vice president, they got 20 visits all around the country this week where they're talking about these programs. Secretary Pete is going to be down in Louisiana. Indiana, talking about a bridge project, won a grant, same type that they had for Brent Spence, and ironworkers are going to be there along with the rest of the trades. So they're taking the show on the road. I think it's our job again, amplify that message and really make it specific about how this is important to union workers and workers in general.
Yeah, but not just union workers, Ross. I mean, you know, because this is where, you know, people then point the finger and say, well, all you care about is your members, your special interest. You don't care about the average taxpayer. The reality is these project labor agreements, this prevailing wage laws, this kind of stuff actually promotes a stronger economy locally. And I look at, you know, the tale of two bridges. You look at the Tappan Zee and that thing they built out in California that's never going to be finished. This is two very different ideologies at play. The Tappan Zee was done under a project labor agreement with prevailing wage on time, under budget, and done, as where that monstrosity out in California, never going to get done, way over budget and way over time. It actually never going to get done. So for me, the story is this stuff works and it helps communities, because those wages those workers earn reverberate through the community and help build small business. We got to be telling that story too.
Yeah, these projects, they lift all boats. You're right. It's not just the workers who are building them. It's anyone who's driving over them, anyone who's dealing with these programs. I will say the Biden administration has put a lot of work into making sure that these projects benefit communities too. I mean, the way infrastructure was built out back in the 50s and 60s, was you find the poorest neighborhood in town and you just run a freeway right through it. And you cut everyone away from their jobs, kills the communities. All of these programs that are being run out of the administration are about that type of community engagement, making sure that these are programs that are going to lessen traffic, reduce idling of big trucks next to poor neighborhoods to help with air pollution. So this is a broad-reaching benefit. And again, given the scale of these programs, I think this is something that's going to have a long, long tail where it's benefiting folks for decades to come.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot coming, and most certainly, like I said, you're going to need a lot of members. So I want to go back to that apprenticeship thing. because I think it's important that you know people understand what union apprenticeship programs are. These are people coming, getting an education, learning a craft, learning a trade, and not going into debt for a lifetime, and being able to have a skill that is portable. To me, it's one of the best kept secrets in education and in the country.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we need to blow our, toot our own horn a little bit more about it. But you're right. I mean, these are 3 or 4 or 5 year programs, depending on the trade, where folks are they're coming in, they're learning the in the classroom, and then they're going out on the job and earning while they learn as well. I mean, you go in there, you work on an apprenticeship rate as soon as you start, and then every 6 months you're getting a raise. So it's pretty significant. Unlike somebody who's going to an undergrad, you know, walking away with a bachelor's degree, you've been working for employers for 4 years. You have connections, you have a network, you have folks that you can rely on. It really is a huge value. And the important part also is, I think you mentioned it, there's no money up front here. You know, there's no tuition, there's no debt. This is paid for by contributions from union workers and from employers. So it's a great access. I think the next step for that is pre-apprenticeships, is these pipeline programs, because even with all the benefits of apprenticeships, it's still very helpful to have a little bit of orientation before you get into them. It's good to know a little bit about the construction industry. So working with community colleges, high schools, community groups, we want to make sure to we're giving folks that kind of prep. There's a lot of resources from the Department of Labor in getting these programs together. There's, I think it must be getting close to 200 of these programs have been stood up by the National Building Trades across the country. So it's very, very exciting stuff. And finding all those little ways to help folks, especially from diverse backgrounds, get into these programs, that's the goal.
No, it's good stuff. And again, as you said, you know, getting the pre-apprenticeship programs in line. You know, when I was in high school, and this is going a long time ago, we had those things. You had machine trades, you had wood shop, you had metal shop, you had the electronic stuff. You had that we were moving people in a direction to do this, and then somehow, you know, we got away from it, and now it's a good thing that we're valuing work once again. You know, I remember growing up thinking that everyone's going to have a corner office and wear a white shirt and a tie, and that's the only way you were going to get into middle class. It looks like we've got policy moving us back in a direction that the people who can make things with their hands, they can do well as well.
It's refreshing to see with the growth of this infrastructure, with all the manufacturing that's coming out of this legislation too. You know, we're becoming a country that builds things again, and that's very exciting. I'll say, along with apprenticeship, the other side of the coin here is organizing. And that's been very exciting, too. Over the past few years, the win rate at the National Labor Relations Board for organizing campaigns has gone up. You've seen this huge groundswell. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with it, of organizing at Amazon and the healthcare industry, at Starbucks. And that's happening in construction, too. I mean, I'm so proud to work with a lot of organizers over at the ironworkers who are out there winning campaigns out west. There are workers who are experienced. We're doing this work right now, and in a lot of cases, they're working under unsafe conditions, being exploited by their employers in the construction industry. So going out there, having conversations directly with these workers, and finding ways to organize at those employers, turn them into union shops, and allow people to defend their own rights. That's something that, unfortunately, under a previous administration, we did not have a labor relations board that was interested in helping us.
No, you hit on something that I talk about all the time because I think is really important. It's that sense of empowerment in the workplace. You know, I tell the story all the time. I've been driving a truck. I've been working in the trucking industry over 30 years. I have never knowingly taken an unsafe truck on the road. You know, because if something's wrong, you're going to fix it. I'm not moving it. Where I can't say that for a lot of my non-union friends who've had to take stuff out on the road. So that empowerment of saying, we're going to make sure something's right, I don't get injured, I don't hurt someone else. To me, that's another big, big important part of having that union card in your wallet. But Ross, I appreciate you taking a little time for us. I hope you'll come back and share some more with us down the road, because we are rebuilding, reviving, and reunionizing America. Thanks so much, Ross.
Anytime, Rick. Thank you.
Good stuff. Ross Templeton, he is the political and legislative director there at the Iron Workers. Remember, check out their website, ironworkers.org. Want to get your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have the talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. Each and every day, labor's history continues to be written, such as the case in North Carolina. On this day in labor history, the year was 2014, which saw a massive protest in Raleigh, North Carolina. The protest was part of the Moral Monday movement. Moral Mondays started off as and continued as a series of protests against policies enacted by the Republican legislature and governor of North Carolina. These policies included restricting voting rights, changing tax policies to benefit the wealthy, and slashing unemployment benefits. Nearly 1,000 Moral Monday protesters were arrested in 2013. On this date, Moral Monday brought at least 80,000 people into the streets of Raleigh. The protesters had five demands. First was to secure pro-labor, anti-poverty policies that ensured economic stability. They also demanded quality public education, access to health care and environmental justice, reformation of the criminal justice system, and safeguarding voting rights. The North Carolina AFL-CIO has been a staunch supporter of the effort. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten made a trip to Raleigh for the protest. She said of the protest, people are searching for fairness, opportunity, justice, and real change. I believe that search can and should lead to the labor movement. Reverend William Barber II, president of the North Carolina NAACP, has been at the forefront of the Moral Monday movement. He addressed the huge crowd and declared, "You may have thought you were going to discourage us, but instead you have encouraged us. The more you push us back, the more we will fight to go forward. The more you try to oppress us, the more you will inspire us." Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind? Make sure you email me. Congratulations to Democrats here in Pennsylvania. Three big wins in the special elections that just happened on Tuesday. You had Joe McAndrew, who won, the 32-year-old business owner and former State House Democratic staffer, also the former executive director of Allegheny County's Democratic Committee, Abigail Salisbury. She, a 40-year-old lawyer and a member of the Swissvale Borough Council, and Matthew Gergely, works for the city of McKeesport. They are now going to be representatives in the House here in Pennsylvania and going to swing the power to the Democrats. Democrats in this state, I got to tell you, never thought in Pennsylvania you would see Democrats take the House. I think it shows just how, you know, in this state, even with the gerrymandering that's going on, and it's bad, even with the gerrymandering that's going on, that the middle of the road voters are running from the Republican Party because all bad ideas, if any. And that's the thing. I mean, look, I would love to debate ideology. I would love to debate policy. Bring me a policy. Let's tear it apart. But honestly, looking at some of the stuff that's come forth, you know, Tennessee talking about not taking federal funds because, well, we want to teach our kids the way we want to. We're not gonna worry about, you know, the poor. We're not gonna worry about the disabled. We're not gonna worry about any of that stuff. That's pretty remarkable. Iowa talking about, you know, voucherizing everything and using the school, the Department of Education as a pipeline, and the school districts as pipelines into private industry, and then shielding them from liability. Man, I don't even know how you would begin to debate that other than you're just nuts. And I'm hoping the voters, you know, like Iowa, I think Tennessee's kind of lost because I think, you know, really. But Iowa, what happened to my friends in Iowa? That this, because look, Iowa used to, education was in their constitution. It's one of those, it's their identity. And to do some of the radical things that they're talking about, wow. Pretty outrageous. But again, you know, it comes back down to the messaging that we see coming out of the right. You know, there was a hearing today on Twitter. The Twitters, and of course conservatives are all, the Twitters were censoring us. When you look at the reality and balance, it was across the board. Now, do you want a private corporation censoring your speech? That's not really, I don't. But that's not what the Constitution says. Your freedom of speech is between you and your government. If you play on the Twitter app, if you play on social media, those are private industries. Those are private interests. It's not the public square. So, you know, the martyrdom just, and you're going to see it. You're going to see it playing out. It's going to be weird. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you missed any portion of the program, podcast. See you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.